believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
And good morning, everyone. This is Bill Carnes, your host of 2A Radio. Welcome to the show. It's interesting that as much of the country that the Obama regime has started to try and take over, actually just started taking over in different industries, and all the different fronts that they've gathered outside of the administration, such as in the name of Acorn, certain things are starting to fire back. Acorn is going through a lot of judicial and investigative review throughout the country, especially right here in my home state of Nevada, where they have been looked at on several different counts with different people involved with Acorn for voter fraud in this last election. And this is not an isolated incident. I believe Pennsylvania, they're being investigated as well, and even a couple other states. A judge, a district judge, he held another Acorn worker for trial this last Monday on election law violations, and he urged prosecutors to go after the real culprit, the organization that employed him. This is what he said. He said, somebody has to go after Acorn. That was District Judge Richard H. Zoller. That's what he said about the Acorn is, by the way, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. Now, what type of reform are they looking at? Well, they're looking at election reform, things that they can swing, because they are huge fans of the Obama administration, I should say regime, rather. And Acorn has gone so far with public money as well. The federal government has actually subsidized this private group, tens of millions of dollars, and looking at a potential additional $35 million out of the next budget. $35 million for a group that went out, committed illegal acts to help Obama get elected to president. A spokesman for the district attorney, the guy's name was Stephen Zappala, he said following the hearing that the county investigators into members of Acorn and their activities during the 2008 campaigns remains open and active. There's quite a bit of activity aimed at determining if anyone else should be charged. Now, I have to applaud the judge for actually standing up and saying these people should be investigated. All but commanding members of the executive branch, that would be within law enforcement, to do just that. And for the ADA to say, I'm sorry, the district attorney, the DA, to say, it's ongoing, we haven't closed the books. That is good news. Because the more people within Acorn and that organization who are prosecuted and brought to justice, the closer it can lead to more mud on the Obama regime. And we can narrow them down, if we don't actually recall them, to another 3.5 years in office and boot them out. You wanted a change? You got it. And it's not the type of change you wanted. It's like having your better half say, I'd like to have a change in our relationship. You're like, oh, hey, sounds great. And that change is something you fully didn't expect, something you fully didn't want, and something you fully didn't deserve. But it's a change, and you agreed to it. There you go for all those of you who voted for Obama. Getting what you reap. Okay, we got more to come after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, with 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3, listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. 1-800-313-9443.
So it seems as though we have a lot of pro-gun related legislation going on through several states and anti-gun legislation going on through other states and at the federal level. For instance, Ohio just celebrated their, I believe it was fifth anniversary of being able to carry concealed in the state. And they have seen a very notable reduction in violent person-to-person crime in the state. It is estimated that there are far more crimes unreported that were thwarted by CCW holders than are reported. The ones that are not reported far outweigh the ones that are. The reason being, a lot of people who carry concealed will stop a potential crime, be it possibly carjacking or a robbery, potentially a, well, now rape is usually a little different. You're usually going to report those even if you have a gun, not necessarily. If it's somebody that the intended victim knows, far less likely it's going to get reported than if it's a stranger. And most of the time it's somebody that they know. But if it's a stranger, most all of those get reported. So we've got literally hundreds of thousands of crimes every month that are thwarted by CCW holders that are not reported to the police. Now, that seems to be a bit of an issue. The reason is, it's never good to talk to the police because they just love to try to catch somebody in their words or get them on a technicality of some kind and prosecute them on them. And a lot of us know that. We are not interested in having to deal with that. On the other hand, if you let them know that you had a gun and you stopped this crime, then they can start to add up all of the different crimes that were prevented by people who were armed, who had guns. And that would be a good statistic, because as it stands now, when we want to increase the laws and loosen up the regulations to be able to invoke our Second Amendment rights, the one group you can absolutely count on that will be against loosening up any laws or regulations is going to be law enforcement. They will always be for stricter gun control and less of people carrying. They will always favor that so that they are not threatened. Why do they want to not be threatened? It's not by the law-abiding citizens so much. It's by what they say is it's by the bad guys that would be carrying guns. Well, the bad guys are going to carry anyhow. What they're afraid of when it comes to the law-abiding citizens are the more intelligent ones that realize that a lot of cops break the law on a regular basis when they have contact within their conduct of stopping just a standard, intelligent citizen of the United States. Their rights are violated and violated and violated. And it's just SOP for the cops. That's just the way that they do their job. Whether they were trained that way or whether they just got into a groove. Such as the case we told you about last week in Shreveport, Louisiana, where the mayor said, when the police stop you, you've given up a number of your rights, which is absolutely false. It's about as incorrect as you could possibly be. But you've got a stupid person that was elected to mayor by other stupid people, and he just has no idea what he's talking about. Talking straight off the cuffs, talking out his ass, has no idea what he's talking about. And he says, when the cops stop you, they have taken away, they have suspended several of your rights, which is absolutely not right. Rights are inalienable. They cannot be taken away. Privileges, they can be taken away. Freedoms and rights, that is not so. Anyhow, the standard police officer will generally abridge your rights in a lot of different ways, depending on their conduct and your conduct. Best thing in the world is to never actually say anything to the police. There's nothing that it can really do to help you, no matter what they say. All right, cops will tell you, look, just cooperate with me. Just tell me what I want to know so we can cut you loose. That oftentimes is not what happens. And they're telling you that just so you'll start yapping. Don't do it. We had the discussion last week as well, where a lot of NRA members have reported to the National Rifle Association out of Arizona, out of Texas. There's probably some happening in New Mexico as well. I would say California, but it's nearly impossible to buy a gun there anymore. But NRA members who have reported to the NRA that they purchased firearms at federal dealers, FFL dealers, gun shops, and they've brought these guns home, and the ATF has contacted them and wanting to confirm they've got the gun and the serial number of that gun. Now, they're asking for voluntary, I feel like an ass when I can't come up with a simple word sometimes. But they want you to comply, I'm sorry, for voluntary compliance. That's the one I'm thinking of. So that you will actually show them the gun and the serial number. However, they're using very, very heavy-handed tactics. There's a guy in Texas that the ATF agent contacted him on the phone and essentially put him to the point where he felt under duress so much he returned home early from a business trip to appease this agent for what's supposed to be a voluntary compliance. Best thing in the world. The ATF calls you or comes knocking on your door. And they identify themselves as a special agent with the alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives. And they are there to confirm that you bought this gun and that it's got the right serial number. And if you would please show it to them. Just look at them and tell them no. Or tell them nothing at all and just close the door. You could also go so far as just to say, without a warrant, I have no reason to speak with you, or no desire to speak with you, or no, I am not legally complied to deal with you in the slightest. And just close the door on them, or hang up the phone. Just don't participate. If you don't participate, what are they going to do? Well, they can't go get a warrant. So what do they do? Well, they're going to stay in there, and maybe they'll talk themselves into a big enough whirlwind with you that they'll actually be violating the law further than they are and actually be violating your rights, and then you could prosecute them. Keep in mind, the ATF is a federal organization, the Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, as if all of you didn't already know. They are the one group within the entire United States, and they are on the federal payroll. They are federal employees. So your federal government, who's never here to help, always here to kind of suppress, they are the long arm of the law to absolute. They are dedicated to taking away and subduing your Second Amendment rights. Now, do you really want to deal with those people? Do you really want to deal with people whose job it is to suppress your Second Amendment rights? If the answer is no, then give them some of the rest of your rights, such as your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, your First Amendment right, and tell them to piss off. Go away. I don't want to deal with you. I'm not going to deal with you. I'm not compelled to deal with you. Go blow away with the wind. Be as simple as you want. Be as polite as you want. Be as abrupt as you want. But don't go so far that you invite retaliatory, actions or statements out of them. Just simply let them know. It's to the point, I almost want to move to El Paso, go to a couple different gun stores and buy up a whole bunch of guns and have them come knock on the door just so I can do this. And then strap those guns on and walk through the streets of Milwaukee just to see the cops take me down at gunpoint. And then decide whether or not I have the right to carry a gun. And then maybe head over to Shreveport, Louisiana. Put a bunch of pro-gun bumper stickers on the back of my rental car. And see if I can get pulled over and have my rights subdued then. And then just wrap all these people up. Call the ACLU. And tell them that my rights have been violated. I am a pro-Second Amendment. I am a gun owner. I am just all this wonderful stuff that the ACLU doesn't stand for, but because their rights being violated, because the ACLU pretty much exists to interpret their own little way of the first 10 amendments of the Bill of Rights. and have them take all these people to court and sue them. Have them go to court on behalf of the gun owners. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should take about 10 days off and go do those sorts of things and see how far I can get. And just put these people back in line. It begins with you. It begins with your rights. It begins with how you are going to handle it. I flat guarantee if anybody ever comes to my door, I don't care if it's law enforcement or not, I don't care if it's local, state, or federal, comes knocking on my door and says, we'd like to confirm that you have certain guns. First of all, they don't know about a lot of guns that I've got because I have private party stuff, or I live in an area where there is no registration. All registration is giving up that gun to the state. I mean, look at history. Look at the last century. Look at the 20th century. Before guns were taken away, they were all registered first. Then they had a full and complete account of all the guns, and they came and they took them. What do you think registration's all about? Do you really think it's about, well, if we find it, we'll know who the owner is? Well, no, because if it's lost, I can easily report it, and then you can tell me. I keep records of my guns. I'm the only one who does. So, anyhow, little tidbit on how to deal with the ATF. Stay tuned through the break. We've got more to come. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
So here's a question for you. Let's say that unrest comes to all of America, or even portions of America. Let's say it's something along the lines of Hurricane Katrina, or maybe it's a total financial meltdown, loss of social services, and just bedlam throughout the United States. And you live in an area where open carry is allowed. If you remember back to Hurricane Katrina, they were going door to door confiscating guns. There has since been a federal provision eliminating the ability to do that. As well as most states, the vast majority of states have passed their own laws preventing that sort of repeat of gun confiscation in an emergency area during an emergency situation again. The question is, what happens to open carry if, in fact, we get an event that would be similar to Katrina, some sort of loss of services, loss of organization, just bedlam. What happens to open carry then? Will we be allowed to actually open carry? Because I'll tell you, if that am, or where I live, or where I'm traveling through, I will not just be carrying a handgun. I will expect a gunfight to be coming. I'll be carrying a rifle and a handgun. But I will be carrying a rifle. So the question then becomes, if you're allowed to arm yourself, I shouldn't say if you're allowed, if they don't restrict your rights, your guaranteed rights to self-protection and using a gun to do it, but you actually go about your day-to-day business, exposed, or even tax-slung with an AR-15, what happens then? I'll tell you something that happened in Kansas. The state legislature put together a provision that the voters will vote on next election cycle that guarantees within the state of Kansas an individual's right to keep and bear arms for the purposes of self-protection, and that will become part of the Constitution of the state of Kansas, which will be completely over and above anything that happens at the federal level, provided the constituents in Kansas, the voters, actually vote that in. Something tells me it will happen. My suggestion is, throughout the United States, the rest of us in other states should look at this legislation in Kansas and adopt it at the state level in the other 49 states of this great nation. It should be part of the Constitution. Oftentimes, to get into the Constitution, it needs to have a petition signed by X number of people, which is usually a percentage of the population, to be put onto a ballot so the people can vote for it. It doesn't necessarily have to go through the legislature. If you live in a state such as, say, California or Illinois, that are anti-gun to begin with, most of the time, you can actually surpass that process because they would oftentimes try to suppress your right to get this done because it has to do with guns. Somebody chiming in on this comment, we have Dave in New York. Dave, welcome to 2A Radio.
Yes, hello, Bill. I would like to answer your question that you asked as to what would happen. And I'd like to start off answering your question by saying what has already happened. If you look at the Constitution, the only entity that's constitutionally enshrined to keep and bear arms is the people. There is no armed forces in the Constitution. You will find Army, you will find Navy, and you will find Congress having the authority to arm the militia, implying that that is not intrinsic. Congress has to arm the militia. The only entity in the Constitution that's allowed to keep and bear arms is the people. Any law enforcement agency is a creature of the legislature through the people. So let's look at what has already happened. The only entity empowered to keep and bear arms is the people. And now the people, the only entity, is wondering what we're going to let those do to us who don't have the constitutional empowerment to be armed, who we, the people, let them be armed. There were a lot of good speeches on this, Oath Keepers, on Lexington Green on April 19th. So what's already happened is a reversal that we're wondering, well, what is the government going to let us do when in reality it's we, the people, are the only entity that is constitutionally empowered to be armed, and we let them be armed. Not every law enforcement agency, if you look at some of the lower levels of law enforcement at the local level, they're not necessarily armed. The legislature, through the people, determines which law enforcement agency. Again, every one of them is a creature of the people, statutory empowerment, not constitutional. So the bottom line is the American people have surrendered their rights so much that what will happen is whatever has already happened. It's whatever they tell you. If they tell you can't have a gun, you can't have a gun. If they tell the American people you can't have a toilet bowl, I mean, the level of cowardice and spinelessness that we're seeing today in the country, citizens will turn into toilet bowl.
Dave,
so,
you know what?
That's where we are. It's the fault of the people.
Dave, I think you just summed it up with the lack of spine and the cowardice within the United States when it comes to the giving up of rights. By the way, thank you very much for a very well-informed call and very well-put-together idea. I should say your points are very well taken and very well spoken. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, sir.
I absolutely agree with Dave when he says we don't really have a spine because everybody in America wants to be looked at as a good citizen.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Independence Day is our national holiday commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress on July 4, 1776 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. At the time of the signing, the U.S. consisted of 13 colonies under the rule of England's King George III. There was growing unrest in the colonies concerning the taxes that had been paid to England. This was commonly referred to as taxation without representation. As the colonists did not have any representation in the English Parliament and had no say in what went on. As the unrest grew in the colonies, King George sent extra troops to help control any rebellion. In 1774, the 13 colonies sent delegates to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to form the First Continental Congress. The delegates were unhappy with England, but were not yet ready to declare war. In April 1775, as the king's troops advanced on Concord, Massachusetts, Paul Revere would sound the alarm that the British are coming, the British are coming, as he rode his horse through the late night streets. The Battle of Concord and its shot heard around the world would mark the unofficial beginning of the colonies' War of Independence. The following May, the colonies again sent delegates to the Second Constitutional Congress. For almost a year, the Congress tried to work out its differences with England, again, without formally declaring war. By June 1776, their efforts had become hopeless, and a committee was formed to compose a formal Declaration of Independence. Headed by Thomas Jefferson, the committee included John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Robert R. Livingston, and Roger Sherman. Thomas Jefferson was chosen to write the first draft, which was presented to the Congress on June 28th. After various changes, a vote was taken late in the afternoon of July 4th. To make it official, John Hancock, president of the Continental Congress, signed the Declaration of Independence. It is said that John Hancock signed his name with great flourish so King George could read it without spectacles. The following day, copies of the Declaration were distributed. The first newspaper to print the Declaration was the Pennsylvania Evening Post on July 6, 1776. On July 8th, the Declaration had its first public reading in Philadelphia's Independence Square. Twice that day, the Declaration was read to cheering crowds and pealing church bells. Even the bell in Independence Hall was rung. The Providence Bell would later be renamed the Liberty Bell after its encryption. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto its inhabitants thereof. And although the signing of the Declaration was not complete until August, the 4th of July has been accepted as the official anniversary of the United States independence. The first Independence Day celebration took place the following year, July 4th, 1777. By the early 1800s, the traditions of parades, picnics, and fireworks were established as the way to celebrate America's birthday. And although fireworks have been banned in most places because of the danger, most towns and cities usually have big fireworks displays for all to see and enjoy. 56 men signed the Declaration of Independence, thus committing, arguably, the single most treasonous act against the throne of England in hundreds of years. Considering what's been happening within the United States over the past several decades, I'm going to have for you now the Declaration of Independence of 2008.
A 2008 Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, unattended grievances make it necessary for citizens to re-examine the structure of their government and bring about change. We were once a great nation created by immigrants from foreign lands who populated a bountiful continent. We now witness our nation's prestige and our domestic liberties considerably diminished. We who suffer the consequences of a dysfunctional system of government seek to reaffirm our founding principles and to improve upon the structure of representative government. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all human beings are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, government is instituted in society, deriving its just powers from the consent of the governed. However, if a government controlled by special interests becomes unconcerned with the public's well-being and destructive of the people's rights, it is the duty of the people to change that government to provide security and happiness for its citizens. The malevolent, corrupting power of money and the body politic has caused repeated injuries to the public interest. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a suffering nation and a disillusioned world. The presidency and the Congress are steeped in a cult of secrecy that denies the people knowledge of what their government is doing to them and to others in their name. Secrecy is the foremost destructive force to democracy. The presidency and the Congress have failed after the oil shock of 30 years ago to provide leadership to end our dependency on oil. Continued reliance on oil distorts our foreign policy and causes Americans to disproportionately pollute the environment. The presidency and the Congress have been complicit in permitting a small, rapacious, greedy minority of money managers and corporate titans to manipulate the United States and global financial markets for their selfish gain. The presidency and the Congress have redefined the criminal act of terrorism as an act of war in order to maintain the nation in a constant state of war, which, in the words of James Madison, is the worst of all evils, in that it facilitates the control of the many by the few. The presidency and the Congress have obstructed the administration of justice by refusing the right of habeas corpus to fellow human beings, regardless of national origin, and by transporting them to secret prisons in foreign countries to be tortured and held without knowledge of their crimes or their accusers. The presidency and the Congress have plundered our treasury to fund unnecessary and illegal wars and foreign military adventures based on lies and misinformation. The presidency and the Congress wage psychological war on their citizens to induce unfounded and unreasonable fear of non-existing threats in order to militarize America's culture and make us accept ludicrous defense expenditures greater than all the rest of the world combined, when in fact there is no nation capable or desirous of threatening our security. The presidency and the Congress, in pursuit of an illogical war on drugs, export military weapons that violently destabilize foreign democracies. Their war on drugs ravages America's inner cities, destroys families of our most disadvantaged citizens, and put more of its own citizens in prison than any country in the world. The presidency and the Congress encourages and funds our self-appointed role as the world's policeman, becoming the basis for American imperialism and for distorting our nation's budget priorities with excessive spending for the military-industrial complex. In every electoral contest, Americans vote for change, yet real change is never realized. Despite creative advances in the private sector of human society, our public sector government is mired in partisan stalemate, unable to respond to the complex demands of the 21st century. The political structures of our current representative democracy were designed in the 18th century and are not susceptible to change. Therefore, we citizens of the United States, in our capacity as sovereign creators of our government and its constitution, solemnly declare that we seek a greater role in our self-governance beyond that of merely voting and giving away our power to politicians on election day. We choose freedom, the right to participate in the central power of government, the right to initiate and vote on laws, in partnership with those we elect to our governing legislative bodies. As sovereign human beings, we have the innate right to collectively make majoritarian decisions on the policies that affect our lives. We the people recognize that elected officials at all levels of American government have no incentive to share legislative power with the people. Therefore, we pledge our efforts for as long as it takes to circumvent government inertia by directly voting to enact as the law of the land the National Initiative for Democracy. This federal ballot initiative, amends the Constitution in a manner similar to the precedent set in Article 7. It creates an electoral trust, separate from representative government, to implement on behalf of the people legislative procedures established in an accompanying federal statute. The enactment of the National Initiative essentially creates a legislature of the people in every government jurisdiction of the United States, operating in a legislative partnership with the elected federal, state, and local legislative bodies. Enacting the National Initiative in the United States, or for that matter, in any country, continues the major advances in direct democracy begun by the Swiss in 1848 and improved upon when copied by 24 American states and hundreds of American local communities over the last 100 years. The global impact of empowering people to vote directly on public policies that affect their lives will change forever the paradigm of human governance, a goal worthy of pledging our lives, our property, and our sacred honor.
Again, that was the Declaration of Independence of 2008 proposed to you. A history of the American flag I'm going to share with you now. For more than two centuries, the American flag has been our nation's symbol of freedom and independence. Since Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag in May of 1777, it has represented those values in every town and city in America, in nations around the world, and even in space. Here's a look at the historical development of the American flag. First, in May of 1777, the Continental Congress visited seamstress Betsy Ross's store and asked her to sew the first American flag. June 14th of that year, the Continental Congress passed the first Flag Act to establish an official flag for the nation, reading, "Resolved that the flag of the United States be made of 13 stripes alternating red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white in a field of blue, representing a new constellation." July 4th, 1777, the birth of a new nation was heralded as the Declaration of Independence was read aloud again. January 13th, 1794, Congress passed an act providing for 15 stripes and 15 stars to appear on the flag. April 4th of 1818, Congress passed an act providing for the addition of one star for each state admitted to the Union. The flag was to be changed on the 4th of July following the admission. June 24th, 1912, President Taft signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in six horizontal rows and eight stars in each row. Each star was to have a single point facing up. The additional star reflected the admission of America's 48th state, Arizona, into the Union. January 3rd of 1959, President Eisenhower signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in seven horizontal rows of seven stars each to reflect the admission of America's 49th and 50th states, Alaska and Hawaii, into the Union. August 21, 1959, President Eisenhower signed an executive order providing that the stars be ordered in nine staggered horizontal rows and 11 staggered vertical rows. Now I've got a little tidbit about the American flag from Johnny Cash.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, "Your old courthouse is kind of run down." He said, "No, it'll do for our little town." I said, "Your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it." He said, "Have a seat." And I sat down. "Is this the first time you've been to our little town?" I said, "I think it is." He said, "I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night that Francis Scott Key said, watching it right and say, can you see? And it got a bad rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo, beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. She got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee, Beauregard, and Bragg, and the south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving back here at home. In her own good land here, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands is scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare and she's wearing thin, but she's in good shape for the shape she's in. 'Cause she's been through the fire before. And I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning. We take her down every night. We don't let her touch the ground, and we fold her upright. On second thought, I do like to brag, 'cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
Radio with Bill Carnes, 800-313-9443.
In 1775, Alexander Hamilton said, "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for amongst old parchments or musty records. They are written as the sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." These words rung true when Alexander Hamilton himself had an opportunity to help construct the Constitution of the United States, for which the preamble states, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America." The ability to defend this Constitution comes to us in the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. These are the interpretations of the Second Amendment by former presidential candidate Dr. Ron Paul.
The Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, is important to a lot of Americans. Why do you think that is?
Well, the founders were very clear about it, and the assumption went without saying that everybody can have a gun to go out hunting, because everybody was a hunter. But they wanted to be explicit that individuals own guns because they never wanted to have the populace disarm. Matter of fact, they encouraged and they believed that each community and each state would have a militia, which was just a group of people who could be called up in an emergency to be deputized for protection. The Second Amendment was provided, ironically, and a lot of people don't understand this, but it was to protect against abusive government, because they needed guns to protect against the abuse of the king. So They saw the Second Amendment as very, very important. Of course, I see it as so important because I think it was the lack of respect for the Second Amendment that contributed a whole lot to the disaster of 9/11. Because if individuals are responsible to defend themselves or their property, my guess is that if the government hadn't taken over security on the airlines, maybe the airlines would have said that a pilot could have kept a pistol up front and don't let anybody mess around. But unfortunately, before 9/11, they weren't allowed to have guns. They're still really not allowed. At the same time, the government told us not to resist. So they did exactly the opposite. No wonder, well, this was an opening for people who wanted to do us harm. But the Second Amendment is crucial. And if you think about it, the lack of respect for the Second Amendment is in the areas of our country that needs the Second Amendment the most.
Those are words from Dr. Ron Paul speaking on the Second Amendment. Couldn't agree more. There is a huge lack of respect for the Second Amendment, which means there's a huge lack of respect for the inalienable rights guaranteed to us by our Creator and written in ink on paper within the Constitution. I would like to thank everyone for spending their day with me. I hope you have a wonderful Independence Day weekend.